In the coming week, Finland and Sweden intensified the NATO membership process. President Biden hosts an ASEAN special summit in Washington, and struggling Lebanon holds parliamentary elections. It's May 12, 2022, and time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay. Bob, let's kick off this week's show by discussing two countries we don't talk enough about on The World Next Week, namely Finland and Sweden. Finnish President Sauli Niinistö is set to visit neighboring Sweden next week at the invitation of His Majesty Carl XVI Gustaf, the King of Sweden. A focal point in Niinistö's visit is likely to be the news that broke just before we sat down to tape this episode, namely that Finland has announced that it is applying for membership in NATO. Sweden is widely expected to follow suit. What should we make of this news, Bob?
Well, things are moving fast and furiously, maybe even faster than anticipated, since one of the many geopolitical tremors that occurred after the Russian invasion of Ukraine in February has been the coalescing, really, of the Euro-Atlantic community, as it's known, and especially NATO. And we should take a step back and just say, first of all, Sweden and Finland are not foreign to NATO, actually. They've actually done quite a bit of coordinating work through the Partnership for Peace Initiative and on other things. And so they are known to each other. What has really changed the calculus is the stunning change in calculus involving the Russian invasion of Ukraine and the ensuing brutality that we've seen, the ongoing Russian messaging about what it intends to do in Ukraine, which is essentially take over and help bring the entire country under its sway. This has shocked people across Europe, but especially its neighbors, and especially Finland in particular, which shares something like an 750 to 800 mile border with Russia. And as some history buffs might recall, it was involved in a short war in 1939 against the then Soviet Union that involved the loss of territory by Finland at that time. So there's been this bit of growing wariness in the relationship between those two countries and Russia. The calculus really changed after the invasion. They are moving swiftly forward. I think the idea is to have a process in place ahead of the NATO summit at the end of June. That would be really swift. But you're seeing with the announcement today, Jim, in which the Finnish leaders use the words, we must apply to NATO, showing on what they see as an urgent proposition. Again, as you said, Sweden is expected to follow suit. And this visit that's going to take place of the president of Finland to the king of Sweden is going to be redolent of this entire security issue. There's going to be probably a great deal of professing of ties and long-lasting ties between the two countries, and then talk about their shared sort of need for pulling together and standing up for values and against the aggressiveness that we've seen in Ukraine by Russia.
Bob, any chance that NATO will balk at accepting Sweden and Finland as members?
It's a good question, Jim. I think it goes down to these decisions are made by the entirety of the NATO membership. There are, as we've seen with the EU response, in some ways, there are places where their balking is going on, particularly countries like Hungary. It's not clear whether, though, Hungary will go this far. In the case of the EU, we should mention Hungary has balked at the closing off of Russian oil imports, partly because Hungary completely relies on those, and also because Viktor Orban has a relationship that is, shall we say, cordial with Vladimir Putin. It doesn't mean, though, that he wouldn't vote for the extension of NATO. Hungary has supported previous extensions. NATO now has, I believe, 30 members, and Russia has not been pleased by really any in the last several years that have joined. And so I'm not seeing any signals, Jim, that we would see balking going on at this point.
What about here in the United States, Bob? NATO expansion would have to be approved by a supermajority of the United States Senate. There are a few senators, Rand Paul comes to mind, who have been critical of America's foreign policy and of enlargement. Any chance that the Senate may balk at taking on two new members?
Not at this stage, Jim. I think amidst all of the rancor and real divisiveness in the U.S. Congress, which cannot be understated, this is an issue where you're seeing Republicans and Democrats tying together. They're in the midst of approving, I think, something like a $40 billion aid package for Ukraine, for example, but also have been making statements in support of the Euro-Atlantic Alliance. Republicans have some divisions among their ranks. As you mentioned, Rand Paul, there's some in the House as well who would be against this. But I think you're going to find that the foreign policy establishment among the lawmakers is going to pull together and support this.
Just a tactical note, this will be handled as a treaty and the House will have no say in it. Much of the chagrin of House members historically who rankle at being shut out of such big decisions involving the United States, but that's how the framers drew it up.
No, know, it's a very good point, Jim. It's also worth noting that, of course, Russia is not pleased with these moves. The Kremlin has already warned of, quote, military and political repercussions, end quote, if these decisions are made by the Swedes and Finns to join NATO. So, you know, we're looking at a period of heightened tensions. We should mention that, and then two countries are aware of that, by the way. There's been a lot of references to this kind of gray zone that they enter into as this acceptance process plays out in the various NATO countries. And that's an area of concern where you have a country in close proximity, Russia, with a formidable military and cyber forces, we should note. But it should be noted, especially the Finns have very potent cybersecurity and have actually worked with NATO on cybersecurity issues in the recent past. So we could be seeing more action on that front as well, Jim. Russia, you know, it's the week started with the Victory Day commencement, which is a pretty sober affair. You didn't have any sort of major claims of victory. You have some messaging and some pivoting possibly on the messaging. A lot of speculation and as well as analysis that this is a long haul conflict. Others saying, you know, Russia might declare some sort of, you know, facts on the ground in the Donbas region of Ukraine and then try to ratchet down its military incursion. And so we'll have to see how things play out there. But it is adding a new level of tensions to a front, meaning the Western Eastern Front between Russia and NATO, that is already tense.
I should note, Bob, that the details of Finland's and Sweden's accession to NATO have yet to be worked out. There's a possibility that Sweden and Finland may follow the lead of Norway, which is a full member of NATO, but has laid down very strict limitations on how it operates with NATO. There are no foreign troops based in Norway. There are strict limitations on NATO exercises in Norway, and there are no nuclear weapons to be based in Norway. So it may be the case that Finland and Sweden work out something similar. We don't know. One of the reasons the Norwegians, when they joined NATO, insisted on those provisions is because they too share a border with Russia, as Finland does, and they're trying to avoid being provocative. So there's still some other elements that really need to be fleshed out here. What I will note is that the Swedish and Finnish armies and militaries are quite capable. They're actually fairly interoperable with the rest of NATO, and they really do bring something to the table, unlike some of the more recent countries to have joined NATO.
It's a really good point. I think the Norwegian model could stand up as a valid one for these two newcomers if they, you know, carry this forward. And one other thing I would add, Jim, is just among other things, the leaders of these two countries are feeling buoyed by public opinion. Prior to the February invasion, you had still fairly tepid numbers of polling, although there was concern mounting with the Russian military buildup at the borders of Ukraine. Now we have polls showing something like more than 70% of Finns and more than half of Swedes favor joining NATO. So a real pivot in public opinion in those two countries, as well as the leadership very much seized of the matter.
The lesson to Vladimir Putin is actions have consequences.
Very much so. And we're going to see this as the summer unfolds, Jim. Jim, I want to take our conversation back to the United States and the issue of summitry. President Biden is set to host the leaders of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, also known as ASEAN, meetings that actually get going today as we're taping this podcast and continue on through Friday. The U.S. Department of State says it's a summit that will, quote, demonstrate the United States' enduring commitment to ASEAN, recognize its central role in delivering sustainable solutions to the region's most pressing challenges, and commemorate 45 years of U.S.-ASEAN relations. Jim, can you get us a little bit behind that quote and tell us what we need to know about this summit?
Happy to do so, Bob. First, ASEAN members tend to be at the bottom of America's priority list, but that's probably a mistake. The 10 ASEAN member countries combine to constitute the world's seventh largest economy. One of ASEAN's leading members, Indonesia, is the world's most populous Muslim nation. And by virtue of where ASEAN members are located, they are both threatened by China and vulnerable to its coercion. So if countering China is foreign policy job one for the United States, then wooing ASEAN member countries makes a lot of sense. And that, I think, is really the point behind this special U.S.-ASEAN summit meeting. It's just the second one since 2016. It's the first one in person between the United States and ASEAN leaders since 2017. And it is the first summit to be held in Washington proper. The meeting was supposed to be held back in March, but was postponed because of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. As you noted, it's going to mark 45 years of ASEAN-U.S. relations. Things have already kicked off. ASEAN leaders are meeting with Speaker Nancy Pelosi. They're going to meet this afternoon with various U.S. government officials in the trade space, also business leaders. And then tonight they have a dinner with President Biden. Tomorrow it's meetings with Kamala Harris, followed by more talks with government officials, and then a two-hour meeting with President Biden. And all the ASEAN ASEAN leaders have to do all of these meetings while they're probably very jet lagged. So I don't know if this is going to necessarily be fun for them. One really interesting thing about this summit is that there are going to be no formal bilateral meetings. That led to a complaint by the leader of Cambodia. So the United States readjusted it, and the president's going to be having more informal meetings with all of the ASEAN member leaders individually.
Jim, this comes before an important trip by President Biden to Asia, in particular meeting with leaders in South Korea and Japan, meeting with the so-called Quad. Is there any relation to those two in terms of a broader thrust towards conveying to Asian leaders the United States is back in some fashion? Not that it left during the Trump administration, but certainly under President Obama, the Asia pivot was a big thing that was articulated, and then it was kind of reimagined under Trump, and now we have the Biden administration in some ways maybe rebuilding some ties.
Certainly, Bob, all of this is of a piece. The Biden administration came into office wanting to put rebuilding relations with America's partners and allies around the world at the top of the priority list, wanted to counter China. So the administration has been slowly trying to roll out its policies, and this is part of that overall effort to try to build relations to create a counterweight to China. Obviously, China is going to be one of the big items on the agenda, along with Ukraine. I would imagine that President Biden is going to try to be nudging ASEAN member countries to take a stronger position, criticizing the Russian invasion of Ukraine, perhaps even going so far as to join the Western effort to sanction Russia. Unlikely to make much progress there. The one ASEAN member country that did follow the West lead in imposing sanctions on Russia was Singapore. Many of the other member countries have, like a lot of countries across the global South, whether democratic or authoritarian, pretty much decided to sit on the sidelines for this. I expect also that the Biden administration is going to try to push its Indo-Pacific economic framework. That's something that the administration announced last October with sort of broad brush, no real details filled in. We got some more details in February when the administration released its Indo-Pacific strategy. And I expect that when President Biden goes later this month to South Korea and Japan, that we're going to get even more details on what is now known as IPEF. And I'm not sure it's really going to resonate with the leaders of these ASEAN member countries. This Indo-Pacific framework, or IPEF, looks to be an offering in place of a real trade policy. My sense is the reaction so far by ASEAN member nations has pretty much been the equivalent of a diplomatic yawn. What the ASEAN member countries want are much deeper trade ties with the United States. They want greater access to the American market. And that simply isn't on the table for the Biden administration. The most distinctive thing about the Biden administration's trade policy is how much it has continued the Trump approach and how much it has accepted the Trump administration's diagnosis as trade as the source of hard times among the American middle class, a conclusion that is not really borne out by an awful lot of economic analysis.
So if the trade dialogue is, as you say, likely to be tepid, are we going to see the Biden administration talking up more an area that it has tried to either reverse or distance itself from the Trump administration, which is on promoting democracy? And I say that because you've seen, especially in ASEAN nations, an ongoing, really sharp downturn in democracy and democratic benchmarks. We just had elections in the Philippines where a son of Ferdinand Marcos was elected with major populist overtones, succeeding another uber populist in Rodrigo Duterte. Coups in Thailand, coup in Myanmar. The region seems to, other than you mentioned Singapore, not a lot of democratic chops going on in the region at the moment.
If President Biden's strategy is to talk up democracy to ASEAN member nations, he's picking the wrong audience for precisely the point that you made, which is that a majority of the ASEAN members are authoritarian governments. So that message is not likely to resonate. It's particularly not likely to resonate because both democratic and authoritarian leaders can point to what they see as democratic erosion in the United States, symbolized by what happened on January 6, 2021, to disregard the president's message. What ASEAN member nations are interested in hearing is about economic development. These are countries that are essentially mostly middle-income countries to lower-income countries who are looking for ways to grow. And I think that's what they really want to have the focus on. But again, right now, the United States, because of its domestic politics, is not putting a lot on the table. On the issue of democracy or governance, one issue that is likely to be discussed, though, is Myanmar, where we're now more than a year out from the coup. The ASEAN member nations were critical of the coup and and how the new government in Myanmar has governed largely badly. But there hasn't been a lot of real follow-up by ASEAN to really punish the military junta in Myanmar for its conduct. It's in the midst of trying to put down both protests and insurrections across the country, and it's a pretty horrific situation. I will note that the head of the Burmese military junta will not be at this meeting. Neither will be President Duterte, who said he is not coming as a matter of principle. He could come, of course. He's a lame duck president. He could come, but again, he's quite anti-American in his attitudes.
Okay, so if we were looking for major wind in the sails of Asian diplomacy, maybe not going to see that from the ASEAN summit, but we'll have to see.
Again, I think the Biden administration wants to put more emphasis on Asia, building up ties. The problem is it tends to focus on military activities, and what many of the countries in the region really want is to talk about economics. We're not there yet. Bob, let's switch gears and take our discussion to Lebanon, where a parliamentary election is set to be held on May 15th at a moment of political, social, and economic instability in the country. Much of the Lebanese diaspora living abroad has already voted in the election, with more than 100,000 expats having cast ballots. But bring us up to speed on the election, Bob, and what's at stake in Lebanon?
Well, it's as you follow Lebanon, as you start to take a closer look, you could decide that everything is at stake, but little could matter given the recent history of the political leadership in Lebanon. It's hard to put it any other way. This is a broken, failing country at the moment. And there is some hope that depending on how you view the prism of the country, and we should also know Lebanon has dealt with more than its share of enormous challenges and crises in recent years and decades. But we should just walk through a little bit of some of the landscape here in the setup to elections. An estimated nearly 80% of the population is below the poverty level. Inflation rates have caused the Lebanese pound to lose more than 90% of its value. The country is still reeling from an enormous explosion at a port facility that was devastated not only in loss of life of hundreds of lives, but just it annihilated a major grain storage facility, something like $15 billion in property damages overall. And now you have an ongoing crisis. The country's heavy dependence and increasing dependence on grain from Ukraine in particular makes it especially vulnerable to this food crisis that's playing out that we've talked about before, Jim. So it is a country that is heavily dependent and will be for the foreseeable future on outside aid, but it has already shown its political class has been incapable of preparing the way for that aid to come in. There's already aid sort of teed up for the country that has not been properly dispersed because they've not provided the proper roadmap for that aid to be dispersed. I'm talking about World Bank aid, for example, and other outside aid in the billions of dollars, Jim. So what's going to happen? We're looking more broadly at the potential for a bloc led by Hezbollah, which is the Iran-backed political party and also designated as a terrorist group by the U.S. and EU, getting larger. Partly that is because you're looking at a boycott by the Sunni portion of the political class, or a lot of it at least, which could mean something like 30% of Sunni voters boycotting the election. That is because Saad Hariri, scion of the political dynasty there, has chosen to boycott the elections. And this is partly disillusionment with what's been going on in the country and a failure to deal with Hezbollah, which has a rivalry there. I should also note, Jim, according to the 1943 Lebanese National Pact, the president must be a Maronite Christian. So Michel Aoun is the president. The prime minister must be a Sunni Muslim. And the speaker of the National Assembly must be a Shiite Muslim. And so because of that, there have to be those three important elements in the country with some sway. But the political elites to date have, and in recent years in particular, have seem to have siphoned the spoils of Lebanese, you know, economic growth to the extent there is, and aid to themselves while there's a growing divide. And as I said, this huge amount of people who are at the poverty level. And one final thing, there's a large amount of emigration as well. So we're looking at an election that potentially could be really important, but could involve a boycott and also be affected by a large scale emigration. Although, as you said, 100,000 people or so in the diaspora have voted already.
Do we have a sense, Bob, of what the regional powers are doing in Lebanon?
Well, it used to be that Lebanon was heavily under the sway of Syria. Syria's civil war and the assassination of Hariri's father, Rafik, ultimately put an end to that. The Syrian forces withdrew. Iran has sway through its support for Hezbollah, undeniably. Saudi Arabia has some sway as well, but the Saudi sway is unclear. They have a lot of interest in Lebanon being sort of a supportive nation, and they've had their frictions with Saad Hariri. But it remains to be seen seen what are the Saudis doing and saying about the current elections? The United States has shown a great deal of interest because it does not want to see yet another democracy completely fall by the wayside in the region and become a source of instability, especially with Israel as its neighbor facing potential new threat from Iran-aligned forces. So, and that's the Israeli interest as well. So there is a great deal of interest. I should also note on the Syrian front, hundreds of thousands, maybe up to a million Syrian refugees live in Lebanon. This is a country of only 6 million or so. So it's a large part of the population. And as I said before, it's a country that is going to, regardless of the results of the voting, it's going to rely on international aid to get it through life support, if not rebuilding. And so there is a broader sort of international component here, whether you look at the IMF or other major aid groups that want to provide the basic humanitarian relief, in addition to countries with a political stake. So watch very closely, Jim, and it's hard not to go in with a bit of a depressing set of cynicism, but sometimes elections have other consequences.
Okay, we will pay attention, but I take it not a lot of room for optimism.
That is safe to say, Jim. Okay, Jim, well, we have talked our way into the audience figure of the week section of the podcast. This is where listeners can vote on or tweet us at CFR_org. This week, Jim, our audience on Twitter selected journalist shot in West Bank. So staying in the region, what do we need to know about the significance of that?
Well, our listeners, Bob, are referring to Shireen Abu Akla. She was a 51-year-old Palestinian-American journalist who reported for Al Jazeera's Arab language channel. She was shot and killed this week while covering raids by Israeli authorities in the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. Israeli forces have been carrying out near daily raids in the West Bank recently in response to several deadly attacks inside Israel that have killed 19 Israelis and foreign citizens. Those attacks are believed to have originated in the occupied territory. Now, the circumstances of Abu Akla's killing are being disputed. Israeli authorities at first blamed Palestinian gunmen. Senior Israeli officials then walked that claim back. And the Israeli embassy in Washington deleted a tweet accusing Palestinians of firing indiscriminately. Al Jazeera and a journalist who was wounded by the same gunfire blamed Israeli forces. Now, it's clear that Abu Akla wore protective gear that marked her as a journalist. Israelis say they have offered to conduct a joint investigation with the Palestinian Authority, but that the offer hasn't been accepted. The Palestinian Authority denies that such an offer was ever made. And now the Palestinian Authority says it will not give Israel the bullet that killed Abu Akla because, let me quote the spokesperson here, we don't trust them. The United Nations has called for an investigation, an independent investigation. The U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas Greenfield, called the killing horrifying and tweeted that the United States demands an immediate and thorough investigation into the tragedy. Now, all of this comes as Israel is hoping to entice Saudi Arabia into closer cooperation as part of the Abraham Accords. I had a great conversation with our colleague Stephen Cook earlier this week on The President's Inbox, our sister podcast on just these issues. And it's also coming as President Joe Biden prepares to visit Israel next month, his first visit since taking office. And this could create a whole new series of tensions for that visit.
Jim, do we think the comments, the rather consistent and strong comments from the Biden administration on this killing might have more impact than some of the other condemnations and leading to some sort of independent investigation?
The short answer, Bob, is I don't know. U.S.-Israeli relations can be, as you well know, quite complicated. The fact that Washington calls on Jerusalem to do something doesn't mean that it will. So we will see how all this plays out. But again, the president is set to visit Israel next month. And I would imagine both sides have an incentive not to want this to become a big problem before that meeting.
And in a time of heavily crowded global developments, this is another one to keep an eye on, given its potential for really escalating.
Well, it certainly is, Bob. And again, the general rule is that while we might like to have one crisis at a time, the world is not required to heed our wishes.
Well, that's our look at the turbulent world next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. The United States, Belize, Germany, Indonesia, and Senegal co-host the second global COVID-19 summit. Japan's Prime Minister Kishida hosts the Japan-EU Leaders Summit, and NATO foreign ministers meet informally in Berlin.
Please Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. The articles, books, and podcasts mentioned in this episode are listed on the podcast page for The World Next Week on CFR.org. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the host or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program is produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Zoe also did double duty as our recording engineer. Thank you, Zoe. Special thanks go out to Margaret Gatch, Nicholas Martinez, and Rafaela Seward for their assistance. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long, and be careful out there.